a lot of aspects of marketing that people see as the be-all and end-all because they're the shiny, fancy parts of marketing. That's the last thing you do. It's not the make a sexy video and put 10 grand behind it on Instagram. I could be wrong, I could be doing it wrong, but I just don't think that's the smart way to spend your money.
Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast. My name is Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast is a weekly show going out every Thursday at 6 a.m. where I sit down and chat to some of Ireland's most interesting entrepreneurs and figure out exactly how they started and where they are now. This week, we speak to Dan Nugent. Dan is the co-founder of Amber Eyewear, an eyewear company based right here in Dublin. Dan typifies what it is to experiment as an entrepreneur. His whole business is based, much like my own, around a simple, very low-cost experiment, which has grown into a massive global business. It's a really practical episode, so I recommend you grab a notebook and pen and take down some notes as if you're interested in starting your own business. Dan shares a huge amount of insider knowledge, secrets, tips as to how he grew his business so quickly. Enjoy the episode. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Gary. How's it going?
So, Dan, what do you guys do?
So, Amber Eyewear, it's a Dublin-based company. We design and produce eyeglasses specifically for people who look at screens all day. And now these are glasses, these are blue light blocking glasses. Blue light being the harmful light emitted by LED screens like your phone, your laptop, etc. And our glasses can be worn by anybody regardless of whether you need a prescription or not. So protective glasses for screens, essentially.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you because, yeah, I wear glasses. I have very bad eyesight, but I was just wondering, is it just for everybody?
It started off non-prescription, and over time we've moved into the prescription market as well. So yeah, for everybody.
Okay, is your background in optometry? Are you?
It's not. No. In fact, I'm very new to the optometry business. I don't need glasses myself.
Okay.
I wear them. I wear my non-prescription now. I'm more from a digital marketing background and a marketing background, working in agencies. The commerce, the famous commerce degree in UCD that everybody seems to do. And then I ended up moving to the States where I worked for an Irish agency over there in Manhattan for a year. Came back and I worked in a digital agency in Ringsend called In the Company of Huskies.
Okay.
So it's very much a marketing and business background. The optometry thing was the optical market was an opportunity that presented itself in a weird coincidence. So,
okay.
But now I've been immersed in it for the last 2 years. Probably got a good bit of experience in the area now. I'd like to think.
You're only in operation 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years now. Well, in terms of actual trading, it's just been about 2 years. And obviously there was a period of testing and experimenting before, but as you've come to learn in the podcast, it was very much a side project thing. So it was very informal, the beginnings. But as a proper viable business, it's probably just been about 2 years now.
Cool. So I actually want to talk to you about the testing thing because it was so funny. We're having a coffee. You're like, oh, it's just a test and experiment. So obviously the podcast is called The Entrepreneur Experiment. I'm a big believer in that business. It's just all little micro experiments. It's just doing it. So many people talk about their ideas and, oh, I want to do this and that and the other. And all of it stays an idea. It's when you actually start the experiment, you put it out there, and you're like, right, this is what I'm doing. So how did you guys make the leap from idea to actually selling your first pair of glasses?
Yeah, I mean, I think very few people start their entrepreneurial journey with the finished article ready to go. It's all about baby steps. And if you just kind of keep putting one foot ahead of the other, you eventually kind of get there and keep improving. For us, it was really, as I said, a side project. We had actually, the company was started by myself and my girlfriend Sasha from our apartment in Dunleary as maybe a way to supplement the extortionate rent we're paying. From our backgrounds, mine being digital marketing and hers being digital design, it's a really, really good synergy of skills. We kind of wanted to have some sort of side project. We just had a 1-year-old daughter at the time, and you know, a lot of conversations came up about what we could do or whatever. I was always looking for, you know, trying to come up with little ways to make money. I remember in Huskies they used to call me Del Boy. So I thought I was a bit of a wheeler dealer. I was suffering really badly from eye strain, headaches, difficulty sleeping. getting the Dart home from work every day, looking at my phone on the Dart coming home, looking at my laptop. And I really thought that the issues that I was suffering were coming from the screen. I just thought that this was a necessary side effect of working with computers. That was until I just stumbled across an article about blue light before blue light was a popular subject that it is now. And I remember thinking like, Jesus, this is all the symptoms I'm reading here is exactly what's wrong with me. So I bought a pair of blue light blocking glasses from Amazon, a very, very cheap pair. They had like, I think they had like an orange film over the lenses that eventually peeled off, like very low quality, but they did the job and I noticed an immediate difference. And it was Sasha that said, this could be the product that we could work on, you know? So that's how the opportunity presented itself. So the baby steps kind of started from there. It was, you know, the odd looking into suppliers, you know, in the back of your head, you're always keeping it there in the back of your head, your idea. But like, as I said, it's acting upon those little ideas, those little baby steps. So, you know, you contact one supplier, you get a sample of a product. It's not up to the quality. You wait another couple of weeks, you get another product. And eventually you arrive on a prototype from a factory that you think could do the job. And you work with that factory and, you know, things just kind of build from there. We got designing, used the last of our savings to get a kind of first experimental batch of stock. We loved the product. I think when you love a product, you know, you kind of have to trust your instinct and just be like, right, if I really like this and if I would use it, my target market is people like me. Yeah. So, we just kind of went from there.
Where'd you find your suppliers? I'm always curious about the logistics behind all these businesses.
Yeah, we're lucky enough to be blessed with something called Google. So, you know, you can find, you can find anything that you want through Google, you know? There's so many factories in the world. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, finding the right ones.
How did you weed them down? I suppose that's probably a better question. How did you weed down what exactly you were looking for?
So our glasses are, glasses frames are made in China. So, you know, there's no glasses, I don't think, in the world that aren't made in China these days, apart from very, very high-end Italian ones, I presume. But it was, I don't know how it was, how we filtered it down. It was, I think, like, translation ability is a big one, you know. If you're talking to someone in a factory that has a really good level of English, I think you know that they're probably a bit more serious than ones who don't. And then it was a matter of just prototyping, which is a problem because we didn't really have any money at the time. I think we were kind of willing to put in a maximum of about €1,000 at the time, because, you know, we had absolutely no idea that this was going to be a viable business. But you can get prototypes for quite cheap, and we spent our money like working through this, and, you know, fail after fail after fail, and you kind of start to lose your enthusiasm for it. But
how long did that take, the whole process?
Probably took about 6 months.
Okay. And then you'd say what you want, send off roughly what you thought they'd need, and then they'd send you something back that wasn't quite right? Or how did that work?
Well, the first stage is more just send us what you produce so we can assess the quality.
Yeah.
So this is the very first step. I should say that first. That's the very first step. So it's literally just like, send me the glasses that you produce and let me see what the quality is like.
Gotcha.
And none were up to the standard that we wanted. And I hate saying it, but I was close to giving up. And the very last, well, it obviously would be the very last one we tried, but the last one we tried just before we ran out of our budget for prototyping, they were of exactly what we wanted, like incredible quality, proper acetate, great, really well designed and built glasses. Once we found the manufacturer that we thought could produce what we wanted, then that's when the design and the instructions start. You know, as I said, Sasha is a design graduate, has a really good eye for making things look pretty. I don't so much. So I kind of trusted her instinct on this. And, you know, you get in contact with the factory, and as I said, they speak really good English, and you explain like the type of styles you want, you draw it out, very basic designs at the start, because, you know, you don't really know what you're doing. But it's a fun thing to do at nighttime when your social life has been taken away by a newborn. This is a great way to spend your evenings rather
what
than,
else would you be doing?
Yeah, like relaxing maybe, but it was really fun at the time. And you know, we worked through it, and eventually we arrived at a product that we thought was ready as an MVP, as you call it. we knew about these type of lenses because I had got them from Amazon. But what the big gap in the market that we saw was that all these blue light blocking glasses, they had very deep orange tinted lenses. And none of the glasses that you could buy really were something that you could wear as a cosmetically appealing product.
The lenses were orange. So I'd look at you wearing them and I'd see they were orange.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, so if you're wearing them indoors in the office, you could look like a little bit of a creep. I know.
I'm glad you said it.
This was really where I think the whole blue light blocking glasses market had been confined to gamers and visors and people sitting in the dark with orange lenses. Whereas we were like,
you're not going to sit in the dark with your orange lenses on.
No, you might if you're alone playing games. You might, because you don't really care what people think. But you know, there's so many people working in like really cool offices, like cool people working in tech with computers all the time. You know, this is a product that can really help those people get through the day. What if you can combine the aesthetic appeal of a regular pair of glasses that you would buy in the high street with the blue blocking technology and the lens? You know, you could have you could open up a whole new eyewear segment. Do you know what I mean? So we found out that having the blue light blocking technology in the lens with a clear lens was possible. And this is with a separate lens factory. And it just means that the concentration of the pigment that blocks the blue light in the lens is slightly less.
Okay.
So our initial batch of glasses wouldn't have blocked as much light as the blue light as the orange ones, but they did block 100% of the most harmful blue light.
Okay.
And they, you know, it's like a spectrum, the blue light thing. So if you can block the dangerous end of the spectrum, which is close to UV light,
gotcha. Okay.
That's the dangerous part.
And it looked way better, obviously.
And it looked way better. So we really did combine the aesthetic appeal of your regular pair of glasses with the screen protection that we thought the people working in offices all around the country and around Europe didn't actually have. They didn't know about it, you know? Because I didn't know that. I didn't know that there was a solution to this problem. Yeah. I didn't even know it was a problem in the first place, you know? Because I just thought it was a natural consequence of working with screens.
Yeah, I think a lot of people still do.
Yeah.
I think the vast majority of people, especially in Dublin now, would be working in offices, tech, laptops. It's a huge concentration of people.
Yeah, there's like a statistic from the Vision Council. It's a US statistic that it's like 77% of people who work at computers suffer from digital eye strain, and then half of those people don't even know.
I was just going to say, probably don't know.
Don't even know that it has a name. Do you know? Don't even know that it's a recognized condition.
I'm tired or whatever.
I just have eye strain or something. You know, or don't even. And then probably even less of them know that there's a solution to it.
Mm.
So when we got these initial, I think it was 100 glasses. And we were like, oh God, we've just blown all our money. Like, you know, what if we don't sell any? Because I hadn't ran my own business before. I had a few little side projecty things, but they were very informal and small. But like, we loved them and like, we couldn't take them off. And we're wearing them at nighttime. We were like, oh my God, these glasses are absolutely brilliant.
Okay.
A couple of days, as I was talking, these little baby steps, like you can't believe that you've actually followed through enough to have a batch of glasses ready to go.
It must have been a good feeling when they arrived over. Yeah,
it is to have something tangible in your hand that you've designed and that like it's your. It's not an invention as such, but it's your like alteration of it.
You've created something from your mind.
Created something. A different version of something that already exists that you think addresses a new kind of problem. So that was a great feeling. And then the fun part, you know, it's the branding. Well, the branding had already been done. We've got like a kind of cool little logo on the side, but the design of like the whole package, like for me, unboxing experience is so important for an e-commerce brand. So we, you know, set about like making the whole experience much more exciting than the customer expected it to be. And that's your branded hard case, your cloth, your little insert that goes in and, you know, all this type of stuff. And once you put them all together, it is incredibly satisfying. But like those, to get to that stage took like a good few months, like about 6 months, and obviously not like working on it consistently.
Of course. But you still had a full time job at this stage.
Full time job, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so did she as well, and also as I said, a young child. So you know, it was tough, but you just kind of, I think in your head, you just got to discipline yourself to keep making those little steps, because you don't want to be like see someone else do it. And then you're like, oh my God, I should have just turned off Stranger Things that night or whatever. And
I love that though, because people are always like, oh, when the time is right, when the time is right, when the time is right. It's the number one killer of any good idea, when the time is right, and the time is never right. So people, it definitely wasn't right for you guys, but you just had that idea.
It's funny though, like people say that, you know, it's probably the worst time ever to start a business when you have a 1-year-old baby, but it was actually the perfect time, because before that, like I was at the time, when Aurora was born, I was 25. I think I was 25. So like before that, you know, you have your social life with your friends, you're still like early 20s, you're going out a lot, and you're probably spending most of your free time like socializing, yeah? Which is the way it should be, obviously. But then when you have a kid and you have to kind of stay inside a lot more, you kind of have to find other ways to, I suppose, express yourself or whatever, rather than just, you know, watching TV and like, you know. So we actually found that we had so much more time on our hands in the evening time when she was asleep.
It's really interesting, yeah.
So you're like, I've got like 3 hours here where I know I'm not going to go out at all, like, so I mean, let's try and make it as, you know, as fruitful as possible.
That's brilliant.
You know? I definitely think I wouldn't have started this business if I didn't have a kid.
Okay.
You know, which sounds quite contrary to what people would think.
I think that's inspirational though for a lot of people, because I think that's the blocker for so many people. They have that little mental block of, oh, I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have kids, or I have a job, or I have this, that, and the other. I think that's really inspirational for a lot of people, to show that you can do it. If your mind is right and you actually think about it in a positive way, I think a lot of people would think, oh, I've had a child now. Well, that's me out. You know, whereas you use it as a positive. So what was the next step? You got your 100 pairs. What was next then?
The next thing was the website. So again, for people who don't know much about e-commerce or are thinking about setting up an e-commerce store or have an idea, you might get daunted by the prospect of building a website, managing a website, designing a website. I just have one word to say: Shopify.
I was looking at their stock price yesterday. It's funny you say that, and it was just rocketing in the last couple of years.
It's an insanely good platform. Like, I couldn't believe how easy it was to get a fully functioning shop up and running at the start.
Really?
Now, like, we made significant improvements to everything now at this stage, but you know, getting off the ground initially when we didn't have a clue what we were doing, Shopify is an absolute godsend. I think we got our initial website off the ground for £100.
Wow.
And we made it ourselves. Well, sorry, I have to say, caveat that we did it ourselves, but it's extremely easy. You know, it's Shopify is there's access to an abundance of themes that can be customized or whatever, like, you know, drag and drop templates or whatever.
Okay.
So, you know, if you obviously have to, you write your own content, you get your own photos done. I think, you know, you basically, what we did is we pulled in family and friends to take the photos, model for the photos. Cause again, you know, oh, I just spent €1,000 on glasses. I don't want to spend any more money. So, you know, you pull in a few favors. We worked maybe 4 nights on it, I would say, initial. And we came up, you know, Sasha has a great eye for design. I'm quite good with writing copy as well. So it did look like a good website now. Like, if I looked at it now, I'd probably cringe. But
that's the best way, though. If you spend too long honing it, you'll never start.
100%. I'm very impulsive as well. I have no patience. So, you know, it was just, everything has to be as quick as possible and just get it done. And like, don't delay, get it done.
That's a common trait, I think, in all of us. I can identify.
It can be bad sometimes, but I like to think it's a good trait sometimes.
Gets things done. Gets action taken.
It does. Gets things perfect. Done. It's risk-taking attitude to have, I suppose. It's like, oh, if it goes belly up, we'll worry about it later.
Yeah, but you limited your risk. You limited your downside. I think I've talked about this with previous guests as well. You know, you limited the downside. €1,000, okay, it's quite a chunk of money. But at the end of the day, if you had to walk away, it's not going to break it.
No, it's a bit of disappointment, you know?
Calculated risk, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we went into this with absolutely nothing to lose apart from that €1,000. Like, I still had my full-time job. And, like, so she and, you know... And, you know, you got to take the positives out of it as well. It's like, even in the last few months of this, like, I've learned a lot about sourcing, dealing with manufacturers, branding, blah, 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 this kind of thing. So there's... there's always, luckily, like that was my first proper venture and it actually took off. But even if it didn't take off, I still would have taken a lot of the learnings from that into the next thing as well. So anyway, how it started then, you know, we spent those few nights working on the website, and it looked good. Like it looked good. So I just put it up on my LinkedIn. Hey guys, me and Sasha are launching this new thing. Appreciate if you checked out the website. There are glasses for people who look at screens all the time. They'll probably help you with your eye strain issues if you're suffering from them, or sleep problems or whatever. And you don't really think anything of it. Like, my dad likes it. Actually,
yeah,
I think he bought a pair. Thanks a mil.
Thanks.
But I want a real customer. But then I just got this. This was like the day after. I got this random order from a guy working in Reich. They're like a SaaS company.
Okay.
I think they were based in Harcourt Street at the time. Or maybe it was Camden Street. I actually couldn't believe it. Like, the excitement that I got off that. It was the best buzz ever.
You got the little pop-up on your phone saying he's just bought.
Shopify has an app, and it makes a cha-ching sound whenever you get a sale. So it was my first time hearing the cha-ching. And yeah, you can imagine just how much of a buzz that was. So much of a buzz, actually, that I hand-delivered it into Reich myself. Brilliant. To the guy.
I love that.
And I walked into the Reich offices and I was like, hey, is Andy here or whatever? And they pointed me to Andy's desk, and I walked over and I handed him the parcel. And I was like, oh, Andy, you're my first customer. Thank you so much for buying them. And he just looked so awkward. And he was like, all right, cheers, man. Appreciate it. But just a tip, don't ever do that again to any of your customers.
So I was like, really?
Yeah, no, in a nice way.
Yeah.
In a nice way. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right. So I didn't hand deliver any packages after that.
But I think as a first customer, that's a savage touch. Like,
it's just the excitement. Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you.
Yeah.
You know? Like, and just to let him know that, like, wherever this goes, I'll remember that.
Yeah.
You know? But then, like, when it really then started taking shape was a couple of days later. This was all, like, in the first week, I think. I managed, for my time working in Huskies, I'd met a lot of journalists and that kind of thing. Like, had a bit of experience with PR. Like, my job was SEO, but I did kind of a lot of PR stuff with them. And I had the name of a journalist who was cool in Love in Dublin. I gave her a pair and I was like, listen, if you like them, try them out. And let us know what you think. And she texted me back the day later and was like, oh my God, I love them. I can't believe the difference they've made. And the following day, she wrote like 500-600 word glowing review of the glasses with a lot of cool pictures. And she put a lot of work into the article. And it was the main header story on the Love in Dublin homepage for a weekend, I think.
Wow.
And I remember being in work and... yeah, the sales were just like rolling in, and then we were sold out.
Amazing.
And then
new problem.
I think I asked my boss, could I go home, because I told him what was going on and I was panicking. I didn't know what to do, because you need to ride that initial wave.
Okay.
And if you are sold out, I think you're going to lose that momentum.
Right.
So I kind of had to figure out what to do. And the thing that got us out of that tricky situation was a pre-ordering function that we installed that day then on the website.
That's a great solution, yeah.
And we ended up getting like a month's worth of back orders.
Really?
Yeah, like within the first week. Like, people loved them so much, and like the review was so glowing and loving Dublin. And then we had Roz Purcell wear them as well.
Okay.
And put up a big Instagram post about it. Like,
amazing.
You know, it wasn't sponsored or anything like that.
She'd got somebody given them some, or she'd
well, I had a friend who'd given her a pair. Who'd gotten in touch with her to give me a pair. And like, either she's really, really sound, but she is really sound and metaphor, or she just genuinely really, really liked them.
Yeah.
But a bit of both.
Savage.
And she put a post up as well, which contributed more to this kind of pre-ordering thing that was going on. And lucky for us then, because, you know, stock, controlling your cash flow and stock inventory is really, really difficult, especially at the start when you've got no money.
Mm. I'm always curious about new companies, and we've talked about this with loads of other guests as well. It's like, how did you manage that initial wave?
Bridge that gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to spend too much, but you don't want to spend too little. Exactly like you're saying, when you sell out, it must be terrifying.
It's just guesswork. Like, you never really get it. We still haven't really got it right, but it is just guessing and just making a good guess at what you need to spend your money on. But the good thing about Shopify and being an e-commerce brand is you get paid almost instantly. So we were able to fund the next stage of production of manufacture, where we obviously got a lot more produced with that money that had come from pre-orders, and it's just rolled on since then. So we were incredibly lucky, I think, to have first like thought of introducing pre-orders, and then even just to get that level of interest from the get-go, like
The pre-order function, that's a great move.
Yeah, it sounds so obvious, but at the time when you're sitting there panicking, going like, you know, we've got all this publicity and now there's nothing for people to buy, you know, you could just be like, damn, I'm just gonna have to let it go. But yeah, it was just Shopify has like apps that you can install on your website.
Okay,
so you just install the pre-order app. It is incredibly simple.
That's very clever.
And just Shopify is a godsend.
So you raised home from work, then you put in another order for X amount of payers and got them over as quickly as possible.
Yeah, like we only had 3 styles at this stage. So it was still like a relatively small order. And they came in good time and fulfilled all the orders. We were also very communicative to the people who had pre-ordered as well. You know, the last thing you want to do is make people wait for longer than they expected as well. So
it's always expectations.
I've seen that with a lot of Kickstarter things. You know, you look at the comments and people are like, oh, it was 6 months ago I gave you my order and you still haven't got them.
If you tell me it's going to be 3 months, I don't mind.
Yes.
And you send it to me in 2, I'm ecstatic.
Yeah.
If you tell me it's 3 months, you send it to me in 3.5, I'm raging.
That's 100% it. Yeah. So people are really, really nice. If you send them a message as a human being and be like, I'm trying my hardest, I really want to get these to you, just please like give us a little bit of
people
time.
Forgive a lot.
Yeah. And then they're like, oh, no problem. You know, so people go right back and they're like, oh, thanks for the really nice message, Dan. No problem. I really look forward to getting them. So we didn't have any issues with that. Got them out pretty much on time. And by that stage, you can't even remember now, but then it's like, you've got a bit of money coming in now. It's great fun. You can, you know, dabble in a small bit of marketing and, you know, you can start growing your range of glasses. And can't really remember that initial 6 months, but I worked from
pretty blur, I'd say.
Yeah. I worked from until the following September full time.
Okay. So you were a year in business before you stepped away?
No, about, it was nearly 6 months, five or 6 months.
That's quick.
Yeah, it was quick, but I was actually let go.
Okay.
Yeah. But like, you know, like working for an agency, as is the nature of agencies, when they lose clients, they have to lay off staff because they're essentially a medium.
Yeah.
So, you know, the agency, I think, lost a big client. So I think they kind of knew in there that I was distracted by other things at this stage, and asked me, like, you know, did I mind being one of the people that would leave? And I was actually really happy about it, you know, because then that's another kick up the arse.
It's almost a sign.
Yeah.
It's almost a, well, this is your chance.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it means that you can dedicate a lot more time to it and take things to the next level. And
I was going to ask you, when did you know it was going to be a business?
Probably then, I would say. I would say probably then. And you know, and then I left, and there's a lot of really good financial supports from like the local enterprise office and the Southside partnership, like Intrail.
Okay. So what are they?
I got onto this thing called the. So this is, I think this is good for people to know because I didn't know about this until someone told me, and this was really what helped me bridge that other gap from not being employed, and because Amber wasn't making enough money to pay like a livable wage, you know what I mean? So there's a thing called the short-term enterprise allowance, the Intrio social welfare actually.
Okay.
That's run by them. They'll pay you like a basic weekly wage.
Okay.
For starting your own company for 9 months.
Brilliant.
So, you know, it's not much, but as I said, it's that little kind of safety net that you need to take that plunge. I can see why people don't want to take the plunge and stuff like this because, you know, you've got your financial security there.
Yeah.
You've got obligations, you've got responsibilities. It's incredibly daunting and, like, it's not always going to go smoothly. You know, it's probably 50-50, really. You know, whether you're... Probably could be even less if you're going to make, you know, a sustainable living off it. There is actually all these financial supports that people need to know about. I don't think they're really advertised as well as they could be, you know.
I just hear from word of mouth. I agree.
But they're there if you look. And that was a huge part of the shift from being employed to self-employed for me, because, as I said, yeah, it's that safety net.
Mm.
That safety net you can have, you know, just to pay the rent, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I applied for that and just kind of went full steam on my own. Sasha was still working.
Yeah.
And so I kind of obviously contributed a lot outside of work hours. But then I was there full time on this. And that was around the end of 2017.
Okay. Mm. So when you went full time then, what did you focus on? So what, I'm trying to think for entrepreneurs that are listening, who were just kind of at an early stage like you were back then, you know, you'd limited budget. How did you focus your money and your time on? I think that's, I know for me when I was starting off as well, I wasted so much time on stuff that didn't really matter. What did you focus time on that actually moved sales forward for you?
So a few things. We were having this conversation earlier that there's a lot of aspects of marketing that people see as the be all and end all because they're the shiny, fancy parts of marketing.
The sexy stuff, yeah.
But that's the thing that comes on top. That's the last, my opinion anyway, that's the last thing you do. So for me, it was building that base of becoming a very, very professional and reliable looking product and brand, while also figuring out ways that bring consistent free traffic to the website, because paid social budgets can come and go. And then, like, you know, if you're depending on them, or if they're not converting for you for some reason, then what do? You know, your traffic's gone, and then it's a vicious spiral. So for me, it was investing a lot of, like, most of the money into improvements on the website, you know, because it was still a very amateurish looking job. Like, it was doing really well. I'm surprised how well it was doing. It was probably because we were the only people on the market at that stage. People had no choice but to buy from us. But if I look back at the website, it did still look very amateurish. So it was, you know, improving aspects of that, like getting the proper photography done, then growing the range of glasses, because we were very limited style wise. I think we had three SKUs, which would be three different, I don't even know what SKU stands for. Just use it all the time. But three different frames. So, you know, you wanted people to go onto the website and there to be something for everybody.
Yeah.
And production runs cost a lot of money. There's a huge minimum order quantity.
Okay. So when you start a new line or whatever, there's going to be X amount you're going to have to spend.
Yeah. It costs a lot. So it's not just as simple as, you know, deciding on a new design and like your new colors and then getting, we'll get 50 in and see how they sell.
So it's a big time commitment and money commitment to expand the range. Why did you choose to do that?
To expand the range, I felt that it was necessary for there to be like a selection for everybody. If you're logging on to a glasses website and there's only three pairs of glasses, why would you buy there? Why would you shop from there when you can go somewhere else and choose from like 50 different designs or whatever? So I knew that was the main priority, was to grow the range of glasses so that, you know, there was quirky styles, colorful styles, styles for people who wanted to blend in, styles for people who wanted to stand out. And that's always been the intention, and it still is. You know, we try and blast out new products and designs as quickly as possible. But, you know, it is quite a big investment with the minimum order quantities and production runs. So you got to get it right. Yeah, you know, it costs quite a lot of money. So you can't really even experiment with new styles. You've just got to you've got to think about what your audience wants, come up with the design, and then, you know, take the risk on it. So that was my first intention going full time, was, and with the money that you're making, is let's keep building the inventory. You know, we didn't take any money ourselves for quite a long time. It all just goes back in.
Okay.
Everything just goes back in. So we managed to keep growing the range. And then, as I was saying, then it was on the other side of things, it's coming up with a strategy to guarantee yourself an ongoing stream of traffic. So my background is SEO, so I had quite a good understanding of that. But even before I started Amber, I'd been looking at keyword trends for computer glasses, blue light glasses, blue light blocking glasses, especially in the States, because, you know, whatever goes on in the States usually reaches here a couple of years later.
And so, that's still the truth. I think people think, the internet, no. Oh, the world is small. No, we're still...
A couple of years, for sure. So we can see that this was becoming a very, a very everyday product in the States, but nobody still knew about it here at all. But
it must have been exciting though when you're like,
it is.
I think this is going to be huge.
You're just like, why has nobody asked on this?
Yeah. Am I a genius or am I mad?
Exactly. So you're just, it is exciting. So for me, it was to create a base on the website that allowed us to be visible for these type of searches when it became
right,
when the volume started to increase. And I don't want to give away my secrets, but the,
no, that's fine. Yeah, maybe as much as you want.
But the way it's done is firstly through the content on your website. The content is your foundation for SEO. You've got to make sure that you've got beefy content that addresses the questions that people are going to be asking.
Right. And when you say content, what do you mean?
You have to. Well, what Google does is it serves pages that it thinks will answer the person's question. So, I mean, if you have a homepage that consists of 20 words and a picture,
gotcha.
You more than, unless you're like Gymshark or I don't know, something like that, like a huge, powerful website, you're probably not going to be served as the answer to that question.
Okay.
Quality content and word count is pretty key for that type of stuff at the start.
So is content everything from descriptions to titles to blogs?
Yeah,
all content?
Meta titles, meta descriptions as a basis. And then, it's not about going like, our glasses are blue light glasses. They are the best blue light glasses in Ireland. Not about that. It's natural answers, lengthy, detailed, that kind of stuff. And also to grow your pages. So you can't rank one page on your website for multiple different competitive terms, You've got to create different pages to target these. So it was like growing the website with different pages to target different target audiences. Like, for example, like you'd have, a page dedicated to gaming. Like, and that would be your gaming glasses.
Gotcha.
You fill that with like beefy content or whatever. So for me, it was building this the foundation of a really, really well written, dense website that could hoover up a lot of search queries, And that's your foundation.
You had such a solid background in this, so that must have been a huge advantage that not a lot of other entrepreneurs would have had.
It really is, and I wouldn't even consider myself an expert in SEO from some of the people that I see online. I get advice from people way better than me, but it's even just having basic knowledge, intermediate knowledge of SEO is hugely beneficial because it's such a rare skill that people have. Nobody knows anything about it.
Like, we talked about this over coffee. Like, no one talks about SEO, PPC, because it's not sexy anymore. Everyone's like, oh, I'm on Instagram and I'm doing this, that, and the other. So they were the things you focused on early on, the kind of unsexy things. And what was your next phase then of the business? So you're in it full time now. What was your next, when you looked out, how did you kind of plan the next 6 to 12 months, or did you?
Yeah, so, the SEO thing, it was SEO and PR kind of work alongside each other in a way. If you are getting a lot of PR online, for example, say the Irish Times writes an article about you, and within the article there's a link to ambereyewear.com, that passes on authority to your website, and in the eyes of Google, makes your website stronger and more eligible to rank highly in the search results. So I knew that these two things go hand in hand, both from a brand awareness perspective and from a long-term organic traffic driving perspective. A lot of PR drives, reaching out to as many publications as we possibly can. We have an interesting story. We have a novel product. People in art, there's a great startup scene in Ireland. Not enough to be competing for news. News space, So if
your startup is interesting in terms of, it's not biotech. You can hold it in your hands.
Yeah, it's
and
easy.
Feel it and see it.
It's easily digestible. It's easily understood. You can look at it and be like, oh, Jesus, I want a pair of those.
Yeah.
And you can hold it in your hands and it looks nice and shiny and there's nice branding.
It's tangible, yeah.
Tangible. So there's a lot of people were willing to write about us. A lot of people were really interested in us. So those two things, focusing on those two things. There's a lot of other link building techniques other than PR, but the PR is probably the best because it also brings in the brand awareness and the referral traffic as well. It was really raising what you call the authority of your website, getting backlinks all over the internet from highly authoritative other websites. That's like Irish Times or even like medical websites, well-known blogs, okay, blah, blah, blah. And all this put on top of your foundation of well-written, optimized content is what's going to drive that consistent organic traffic to your website. So
this is fascinating to hear you talk about this, because I think for young entrepreneurs, this is the stuff you kind of want to be hearing, because it's very easy. I'm a victim of this myself. It's very easy to be on social and you'd be like, oh, I should do this and I should do
that.
Oh,
I've got massive hang-ups about, you know, about that. That is a very bad pitfall, I think. I have no doubt that it works for some people, but vast majority of cases, it's firstly, it's unsustainable. You're, excuse my language, pissing in the wind a little bit, because you're putting something out there in the hope that the audience that you've targeted are going to stop what they're doing mid-scroll, focus on your ad. They're probably not going to buy there and then, but you know, maybe you'll retarget them with something and they'll come back. But they are not in the mood to buy, I don't think, when they're scrolling their news, their Facebook news feed or their Instagram feed. You know, I think a lot of startups, like a lot of e-commerce startups, I see a lot of them, like they're even competitors of ours, would focus a lot on these like Instagram ads, Facebook ads, but the likelihood of them converting is far less than it would be if they're bottom of the funnel people looking to actually purchase computer glasses or blue light blocking glasses, etc. And then it's also, you know, the whole influencer marketing thing as well is okay, but I don't want to make assumptions for every business, but it is highly overrated in terms of its effectiveness. We've had experience with I'm very skeptical of the whole market as a whole, because I feel that now people are kind of immune to the messages that are being given out.
It's getting talked about a lot now at the minute. What are your thoughts? People say, I think people are nearly allergic at this stage. People have a very aversion to a lot of the influencer scene at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, there's the same kind of stuff. It's people who don't necessarily add value to your timeline or Instagram feed. They are just walking billboards or whatever, and every single post is a sales pitch. You do become immune to that, and you don't trust it because it's blatantly an ad, you know?
Yeah.
But where it does probably work is somebody with maybe a smaller following, but who consistently puts out valuable content, then I might listen to them. If everything is not an ad, then when they plug something, I know that they're probably being genuine and they use it themselves. But if it's, we tested out that whole side of thing of, like, you know, giving glasses to someone with 200,000 followers who, you know, would be considered like a style influencers or something like that. But the return you see off it is insanely low.
It's really
crazy low. And it's not even in terms of sales, but even in terms of gaining new followers, it's low. I think we've only paid for an influencer to showcase the product maybe twice.
Okay.
And I'd rather invest my money in far more proven effective techniques, as you said, the less sexy stuff, because I know that works, you know. Maybe if we have like $1 million marketing budget one day, then I might do this type of stuff. But it is very much top of the funnel. You're stopping people in their tracks and going like, hey, please look at us, quick before you go. It's kind of that, rather than somebody going, I want computer glasses. And then you go, oh, here they are. It's the two different sides of that. So for the moment anyway, I'm putting the influencer marketing on hold. I think I think there's better ways to spend our money.
What would be, just, I always kind of think of who would be listening and what they might be looking for. So in where we are now in 2019, what would be the couple of things you'd spend, let's say €1,000 to spend marketing budget for next couple of months, what would be the first couple of things you'd spend it on?
That's a tough question. What I would spend it on is, I would spend it on a few guest posts on highly authoritative blogs.
Okay.
With do follow backlinks. Perfect. What that means is that the authority will pass onto your website.
Okay.
Because that's part of the long game.
And so that'll deliver consistent traffic over the next.
It will contribute to it. You know, it's no guarantee, but it will take you up. It will take you one notch up the ladder. Pass authority onto your website, because I think that should be the main focus for every single new e-commerce business, is to build authority to your website. I could go in and spend £1,000 on an Instagram ad, and maybe I get two sales off it. Do you know? Mm. Or else I could sell 1,000, but that's highly unlikely.
Okay. But it's fascinating to talk to someone who's willing to be as honest as you are about the whole scene and give valuable advice to people. I think people are very much swept up in the moment of social. And there seems to be a tipping point. This year seems to be a real tipping point for social in terms of people turning their back on it, the kind of movement towards less screen time, you know, less things like that. Whereas what you're saying is, you find the customer at the exact moment they're looking for specifically what you're selling.
Yeah, definitely at the start, when you don't have massive marketing budgets to play around with, you should definitely spend your money on stuff that you know is going to work. I've also like experienced in my dealings with a lot of like influencers, the costs that they would charge in comparison to the ROI, like the return on investment, is insane. Like, you know, if I ask, I get a lot of messages going, oh, would love to collab, i.e. I'd love a free pair of glasses and I'll wear them on my Instagram. And I always ask, like, you know, this might sound disrespectful. It's not disrespectful at all. Like, I do understand the value of some influencers, but a lot of them, the ones I see, they're just in it to get free things. They don't give a shit about your product. They don't give a shit about helping your brand. They probably send the same message to 10 other brands, yeah. You know, it's the copy and paste message. And then I'll always go like, oh, can you provide some statistics on the conversion rate or rate of impressions or ROI or something? And then they just don't write back.
Lovely.
Do you know what I mean? And then...
But in what business transaction would you ever go,
that's it,
I'm going to do this for you, but I'm not going to back it up with any evidence or any proof.
You just got to trust me. You know, you just got to trust me that this is going to be good for your business. I genuinely think that they do think it's going to be good for their business, but there is also the element that they might have lofty opinions.
Do any of them offer performance based?
So I was just about to say that is what if we are going to do that type of stuff, that's how I pitch it. If I get asked, and I do think that this influencer is going to offer us a good mutual beneficial relationship, because again, I don't want to dismiss the whole industry, because there is 100% really, really valuable people to work with out there. But I always try and go like, well, listen, you know, rather than you saying, give me €3,000 for an Instagram story, why don't we do a performance-based model where you get 20% of every single sale that goes through the swipe up link, you know? Yeah. And it, like, even if they don't purchase right then, it will store the cookie. And if they buy the product within 30 days, it will attribute the sale to the first click, you know? So we've got that software. Costs a bomb, unfortunately. But we do have that capability to offer the software that will track that, pay to each bank account, no messing involved.
Brilliant.
That kind of thing.
That's class.
Affiliate marketing software. So we've got that. So I can offer that to people, but you'd be amazed how many people turn it down, you know? And which is fair enough, you know, they've got their own business model. But I think that's a lot more of a fair way. Definitely. To do business in the influencer marketing world.
In the gold rush of the last probably couple of years.
Yeah.
Probably like, yeah, here's two grand. Whereas now people are like, it's kind of like an 80-20 rule. I think you can see probably 80% of them just fading away. The billboards just going away. And only the ones that are, who actually base their influence on something, whether it's a profession or whether it's they're an expert in certain things. I think they'll always remain, but there's 80% I think will just get washed away.
Boom pictures.
Pretty much. Yeah, I was dancing around it, but the Instahans and people who aren't, you know, are you entertaining me or are you educating me?
Or are you teasing me?
Well, that's pretty much it,
you know,
isn't it?
Like, this is going on to a different thing, but we're starting this like monthly newsletter where we, you know, we don't want it to be salesy or pushing sales on things. We just want to provide people who are interested in our brand with like a cool summary of cool things we've seen that month that they might be interested in, and might provide them with a little bit of entertainment in their workday. And like one of the things we're trying to say this month is that is like we're trying to do like a tip, like a mindfulness tip. And this month's tip is to try and unfollow 10 influencers who don't bring value to your life. Because even for me, like I'm not usually someone that gets bogged down in this type of stuff. It doesn't affect me as much as it affects some. But even sometimes if I'm at home, like watch TV and I'm just a little bit bored and I see someone in this like beautifully picturesque Santorini villa, I'm just kind of like...
They're all in Santorini this summer. I don't know what that's about.
I know.
They're all over there.
I know, it's crazy. Well, they just go there to take the picture, you know? But to me, it's like I can see how that would really, really, really damage some people if they're just bombarded with that every day.
Yeah, you're sitting at home in Dublin on your couch watching Netflix, and you're like, they're living their best life.
It's definitely, it's not healthy at all. And I don't really see any reason to follow these people, you know? I don't want to sound like pretentious or anything like that, but it's just not good for your mind at all. So even like from an ethical perspective, I don't really like working with those people because I don't think they care about their audience or whatever. I think it is just it's a vanity and a money making project. I think it's not a mutually beneficial relationship between advertiser, audience, and influencer. I think it's just like looking out for number one kind of thing.
But that's how a business always works. You know what I mean? You would pay X amount to a magazine that would put your ad in the paper. You would be guaranteed that 200,000 people will see it, and over time it'd be delivering results to you and you'd be able to track it and things like that. But yeah, it's a strange model. So jumping back to, you've just gone full time. How did the next kind of 6 to 12 months look for you?
Well, I can't really remember. There was like a few, it's just baby steps. And it is working on new products, you know, like we launched like 12 more frames after that. And then I think we're up to like 35 frame styles now, which is really cool. Like we nearly have an inventory and a selection that can compete with some of the bigger optical brands, you know, some of them that we were talking about earlier in Dublin, like with proper shops and stuff.
Yeah.
And people love the designs as well. So, I mean, all of them have resonated with a certain audience as well. And people, you know, people have their own ones and it's cool. And like, that's been something that we worked on a lot. And then not just the styles, but the products as well. We want to be the most innovative blue light blocking glasses brand in the world. Like we don't just want to rest in our laurels and just have the standard non-prescription blue light blocking clear glasses. These are the ones that you see being drop shipped on Instagram from a lot of for like a tenner, you know. Obviously not our ones, but you see some brands that they're just getting the very basic frames or the very basic blue light glasses and trying to pass them off as their own designs or whatever, and they're very low quality or whatever. But we don't want to just provide the standard blue light glasses, non-prescription. We worked really hard to provide prescription, you know, working with a proper ISO certified optical lab. We do like progressive lenses, blue light blocking. Everything is blue light blocking, by the way.
Yeah.
Progressive lenses. I don't think there's any other blue light glasses brand in the world that does that.
What's a progressive lens?
So it would be for people who have different prescription needs for both distance and reading.
Oh, okay,
so yeah. Top part of the lens is distance. You probably wear it while you're driving, and then the bottom is for lens, okay, is for reading. So we do that. We also just launched the Amber Ultra range, which these are the orange tinted ones, by the way, that we didn't like at the start.
Yeah.
But there is a market for them at nighttime. You know, we aim them at nighttime. You kind of keep them on your bedside table. They do look like something out of Star Wars, but they're specifically to regulate melatonin production at nighttime.
Oh, right.
When you're on your phone in bed or whatever, pop them on a couple of hours before bed. And they specifically block 100% of the range of blue light that affects melatonin production. Okay. So we kind of, you know, keep them on your bed night's table. Okay. We promise you your best sleep, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's a new range. There's Amber Transition now, which are blue light blocking, clear blue light blocking glasses when you're indoors. And then when you go outside, they turn into like funky sunglasses.
Okay, yeah.
But not just the ones like your granddad might have had, the like creepy old gray colored ones.
Yeah, yeah.
But our ones like can turn like pink, green, blue. So they look really cool. They're like, you know, a new kind of evolution of transition glasses. Yeah. We've got those. We've just launched sunglasses as well. So all in all, there's like 120 different products now.
Wow, from three.
From three, yeah.
In how many years?
Two, yeah. So as you can imagine, that's pretty much been the drive, is to get as big a selection as possible. And then, you know, on the side is the marketing stuff, pushing the PR as much as I can, pushing as many good affiliate partnerships as I can. And when I say affiliate partnerships, it's away from the Instagram thing mostly. Yeah. It's more so with publishers. Affiliate marketing is isn't something that's really done in Ireland, because I think we have such a small country. The media here, they don't really, I don't think they have much competition, or there's not as much things to write about or something like that. So stories, it's quite easy to get into the media here, I think, if you've got an interesting story. Whereas maybe in the States, you're competing against millions and millions of other brands to get that
space. And every
space.
City has a paper. And yeah, there's, yeah. yeah.
So with our affiliate marketing, we managed to get articles in some of like the world's best publications. February 2018, we got an article in Forbes.
Wow.
And it was, the title of it was Best Places to Buy Glasses Online, Warby Parker versus Zenni Optical versus Amber Eyewear. It was bizarre. And how that came about was just by pure chance. I was at Web Summit the previous November in Lisbon. And one of my mates had gone out for dinner with them. He had some special ticket where he got to meet some CEOs like that.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how he got it, actually. But he managed to be there. He ended up making friends with this really cool guy from New York. And the two of them wanted to leave that specific party. So he gave me a call and he was like, where are you? Do you want to go for a pint? So he brought his new friend to have a pint. Turns out his friend was one of the main heads of the Forbes Online.
Wow.
And I told him about the glasses and he was like, man, I'd love to write about your glasses. Do you do affiliate marketing? He spent the night explaining to me about affiliate marketing.
I do now.
Really interesting conversation to have over a pint for my friend who was there third wheeling.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he taught me all about affiliate marketing. He said, once you get the affiliate marketing set up, contact me, I'll put you in Forbes. So he did. And that really took us up another level once that article was published.
Had you primarily been Irish focused before that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Jesus, actually, come to think of it now. So that opened up a US audience. It wasn't just traffic from affiliate marketing that increased. It's weird the way every big step brings up everything else.
Okay.
And then it plateaws at a higher level.
Okay.
I've always noticed this. So like these little steps, you go up and then you plateau at that higher level. Something else happens, you go up a little notch again. So this was one of those notches. I started teaching myself about affiliate marketing, and affiliate marketing then enabled us to have articles in Mashable, Huffington Post, The Daily Telegraph, CNN. There's a few more as well. Esquire. So wow, all those articles, yeah.
Big. When you say affiliate marketing, for anyone completely new to it, is that just a revenue split, or how does that work?
It's a revenue split. Yeah. It's commission, commission based.
Okay.
Like writing about, it's a new revenue stream that publishers are exploring. Not even exploring anymore. It's probably a main revenue stream for a lot of big publishers, because obviously, you know, the revenue model has changed a lot for online publishers. So this is the way that they make money now.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, and like, they don't just write about anything. They do test out the product, and if they like it, they'll write about it. But it's been great for us. And all those articles, they are permanent on the internet as well. So they're not like someone putting up an Instagram story that's gone in 24 hours. Yeah. These are permanent articles that stay there forever.
And people are Googling. Amber Eyewear or Warby Parker, and they're coming across you.
Exactly.
Amazing.
So there's consistent traffic every single day off those articles for us. It's hard. It's really hard to get them. But once every 3 months, maybe, you get one.
Okay.
And it's great. It's a big thing for the business, you know? So yeah, that really, concentrating on that brought us to the next level. We launched a new website last April. I think I've skipped a lot of time there.
You were busy in the meantime.
Yeah.
Well, 130 new products and all the new partnerships.
Baby steps like that. And you find out what works and what doesn't. And these are the things that really worked, and you double down on them. We've launched 3 new websites in Spanish, German, and French. I've done my research, keyword research on those markets, and there's a big demand for these products. So
is that a big undertaking when you go into a new language for your website?
I'm very much like, we'll do it and we'll figure it out as we go along.
Okay.
Obviously, yeah, the investment to get them translated, because it's professional translations that have to be, is quite expensive. And they're quite new, so they haven't really, you know, started picking up momentum yet.
Gotcha.
But it's, as I said, it's the long game. It's not the make a sexy video and put 10 grand behind it on Instagram. I could be wrong. I could be doing it wrong, but I just don't think that's the smart way to spend your money.
Well, not when you're on a budget at the start.
Not when you're on a budget.
Single euro count.
Yeah, because we're bootstrapped. Like, we've never got money. It's brilliant. it's just been that initial thousand or so quid, and then rolled from there. So yeah, having a big wedge of cash in the bank account has never been a thing for us. I know that if we can make these small improvements and these baby steps every single day, you eventually get to a place. You probably never ends, but you know, every 6 months or so, you can look back and look how far you've come. You know, even though at the time they don't really seem like big changes,
yeah,
but they all add up. You know, it all adds up to basically just being bloody everywhere, like being as many places as you can is the target. You know.
And what is the next step for you guys now? So you're 2 years in operation. What's next in terms of RQ? You're shipping across the world now.
Mm.
What do you want? I know we talked about some loose plans earlier, but what, when you look ahead, say 6 months, what are you aiming to do?
Yeah, so a big one for us is expanding our distribution partnerships. 95% of our business is through our own website. We did manage to get two permanent fixtures in Brown Thomas on Grafton Street last November. Really, really nice units that are, there's one in the women's and one in the men's, and that currently that's the only place where you can buy our glasses outside of our website. But to, you know, we really want to get into the rest of the Brown Thomases in Ireland, and that's also controlled by Selfridges Group as well. So, you know, hopefully maybe there'll be a little in there. Particularly made moves to do that, but increasing our presence in brick and mortar department stores. I think it's difficult to find places that you think are suitable for the glasses, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just put them anywhere, you know.
What price point are your glasses?
So non-prescription are €55.
Okay.
And you can only sell the non-prescription ones in non-licensed optician stores. So gotcha. They're the ones that we'd be
okay.
pitching
they're
to.
They're the ones you can roll out.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So yeah, there's like, we could go after chemists and stuff, pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't feel that that's right for the brand, because we're trying to position Amber as, you know, a really, really cool, slick...
You're not granny's reading glasses.
Luxury,
yeah.
Lifestyle brand, yeah. You know? And we want it to be more than that. And I think Brown Thomas was a massive coup for us, because I think that's the best place to sell in Ireland. Mm. Like, the first place we got was probably the best for you to do in Ireland.
I think if you're in Ireland, and if you're saying you're Brown Thomas, I think that's probably the pinnacle for a lot of brands. I think that's probably their number one, never mind their first one. I think that'd be their ultimate goal.
Yeah, it was. I'm thankful for them for taking the chance on myself, who arrived in their office with a sweaty t-shirt and a backpack on full of glasses.
I was going to ask you how that came about. Yeah,
it came about through, my dad swims down the 40 foot in Dún Laoghaire every morning. And he swims with a guy whose brother is one of the buyers in Brown Thomas, and he'd been telling him about Amber and how it was going. They're interested. He told his brother.
I love that.
And his brother was like, send them in and show me. And I went in, and you look at me now, I'm in shorts. I hate dressing up formally or being formal. I hate formalities. So I had like a gammy white t-shirt on and a backpack and runners and glasses in my bag or whatever, and I showed them to them, and I told them the story, and they checked out the product and they absolutely loved it. And there was no pitching. It was like, right, when can we
story.
Get this in?
Yeah, story is the key, isn't it, to any brilliant brand? The story is always the backbone.
The product's the most important thing in terms of, you know, they're not going to put a crappy product out, but then the story on top of a great product is as you said, it's the backbone, really. So that rolled out last November. Our plan is to get in more places. We're finding out in the next week whether we have a potentially really big deal on the cards, which would be international.
Great.
I don't want to say what it is.
That's fine.
Piss some people off. And
hopefully we can crawl on in a few more episodes time.
Shout. If we get it though, I think people will find out about it, and it would be great for us. So pushing that side of things, then making sure these international websites take off, obviously improving our English website to, you know, we've taken on a PPC.
Mm.
PPC isn't really my realm, like paid advertising. I'm kind of a free traffic type of person. I like to think I specialize in getting traffic for free.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about getting traffic for money. So got a guy on who's doing really well with that, and that's opened up a whole new channel of traffic for us.
It's interesting to see, and I've seen this theme with a few brands we've talked to, people moving from online to offline. So people moving from being purely e-commerce to actually being in bricks and mortar stores as well. It's interesting to see that switch. Everyone's talking about the high street dying, but there's still a huge...
Well, it's that thing that, you know, that Warby Parker have. It's integrated. Mm. Their online and their offline is integrated. Maybe you use their shop to try on glasses before you buy them online. Maybe vice versa. You look online and then you know when you go into the shop that you're going to buy. The two of them work together.
Yeah, definitely.
They don't cannibalize each other. It's like a double offering. Mm. So that's probably our main plan actually for the next 6 months. It's not completely finalized yet, but it's pretty much finalized. I'm not going to say where, but somewhere very, very special. We're going to have our first brick and mortar store.
Fantastic.
And we've got some really, really cool concept to play around with, I hope. And I think it's going to bring something new to this industry. And I think it could be something, you know, for me, exciting. For people who are interested in glasses and, you know, wearing glasses and our brand and stuff, I think it could be an exciting addition to the Dublin High Street. So trying to get that over the line now in the next 6 months. So between distribution partnerships, our own bricks and mortar store, and really, really doubling down on making our website one of the biggest in this niche in Europe, they're kind of the three main focus. And we're still doing that with just a three-person team, so...
That's what was literally just, you read my mind, I was just about to ask you, I'm obsessed with productivity. I'm obsessed with like just getting a little bit better every day. How do you plan your day and your week?
I'm probably different than most entrepreneurs you'd have on here. I'm not the most organized at all. I'm very erratic, and it's something that I really need to fix because I'm all over the place at the moment. I wake up late. Our office is like 100 meters from our apartment. I wake up late. I skip breakfast or something.
I think that's a hack in itself, but having your office close by.
Yeah, it is.
Even little things like that play a huge.
It is.
Huge,
but then you fall into bad habits of oversleeping and stuff. But in terms of the productivity, yeah, I'm very much obsessive. Like if you ask my girlfriend now, she badmouthed me a lot for the last 2 years about how obsessive I've been.
Okay.
Like I feel it's necessary, but I think sometimes I take it overboard. Like when I'm watching live Google Analytics at 10 p.m. on a Tuesday night, which is almost, swear to God, almost every single night.
Really?
And it's a really bad habit.
It's probably a little bit addictive though.
It is, because what I've essentially done is I've gamified my life.
Okay.
I have, as I said, I've got that Shopify app that goes cha-ching every time there's a sale. And that's like my dopamine hit.
I'd say that never gets old.
And if I don't get enough dopamine hits in that day...
I get you.
Then okay. I start to worry. I'm like, oh God, are we going to sell enough this month? You know, like, are we going to reach the target this month?
Okay.
I don't think that's very good for your mental well-being at all.
It's your social media addiction is your... So instead, most people are addicted to social media and Instagram, and they hit there. That's yours.
Yeah, I'm addicted to live Google Analytics.
We've just got the promo teaser clip right there.
Yeah. No, it's not nice at all, and I haven't fully made the conscious decision to stop yet because I still think my obsession with that has helped me to notice issues very, very early.
It's a fine line, isn't it? Especially in the early days, it's a fine line. I think you have to be obsessive. I think you have to be a little bit unhealthy in the early days.
Yeah, I think so too. And that is my excuse. But I do worry sometimes that it's affecting my relationship with my daughter as well. And like sometimes I'd be looking at, you know, something on my phone to do with the business. And I just kind of, you know, come back into myself and I'm like, geez, I should be playing with her.
Yeah.
My viewing of how many people have been on the website today and what their behavior has been doesn't change the fact that it's already happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's what we all have to realize as entrepreneurs. You know, this has happened, and taking a more macro view, whether it's a weekly, probably weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly, been able to step back. That's something I'm working on hard at the minute, is actually taking a step back and planning, you know, my week and my day and my month. So it kind of feels, it gives me a bit of control in terms of, I know what I have to do. I get kind of like almost anxiety from having, you know, yourself. I met someone recently and they were like, oh yeah, you know, Thursday was so busy, I almost didn't get my to-do list finished. I was like,
You have a to-do list?
What? Mine's, it's just never ending. As an entrepreneur, you never will have a to-do list that's finished. You never go tick, 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 done. Mm. I'm finished for the day.
Mm.
I think that's something I'm trying to find systems and ways to deal with that. You know, setting yourself realistic goals. If I get this done today, that's good.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm. And that is what I'm trying to work on as well. I've got month-long goals that I'm like, they are my priority. Yeah. I have to get that done by the end of the month. All this little stuff shouldn't keep me awake at night. Like, all this little stuff isn't as important as I think it is.
Yeah.
So it's for me, that's probably when people talk about being an entrepreneur, or having an e-commerce store, as if it's like the dream or whatever, you know, it comes at a price, and that price is you're open 24/7.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you're responsible. Nobody gives a shit about it but you.
Mm.
You're not guaranteed anything. So you do have to become obsessive. And I'm really looking forward to the day where I don't have to be as obsessive. And I'm trying to work on it at the moment as well. I'll tell you when it's ultra bad is when you go out at the weekend and you wake up on a Monday and you open your emails and there's a ton of support emails and then a ton of things that you have to do. And even missing a day of productivity is really, really, really costly.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of, I kind of envy my friends in some way where like they can go out and you wake up the next day and you can just, oh, it's grand, I don't have to worry about it until Monday.
Today is a perfect example. So today we're recording this on Friday before bank holiday. And most people will finish today.
I won't have a bank holiday.
$3,000-$4,000 off the weekend, see you Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
Whereas most entrepreneurs, it's... And I love that, to be honest. I think that's probably a little bit of weakness. I love the fact that there's always more and there's always like, because it kind of rewards that kind of personality whereby the more you do, the more you get.
Ooh,
in terms of that kind of like, oh, you know.
I'd be looking at this Monday now as a head start.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So like, I'd be looking forward to Monday now that I'd be very smug.
It's like I'm living in the future.
but yeah, you know, yeah, if I mean, and what makes me feel better sometimes about this is like, if I'm working this hard, I don't think any of my competitors are working this hard, therefore they can't beat me. Do you know what I mean?
Same.
That's another thing. Yeah. And that's probably a bad notion to have as well.
No, I say that to my wife. I'm always like, not the smartest, you know, not the brightest, you know, don't have PhDs or anything, but I'll always work hard.
Yeah.
That's the only thing you can control, I think.
Yeah.
The only thing you can control. You have to be smart, you have to be relative level of smartest, but I think if you're a hard worker and you've good systems brain on you that you can just write this one I need to do. And this is, I think some people go to work and they're like, oh, 12 hours today. Yeah. Put in a big 12 hour shift. Mm. And for 7 of that, they're pissing around.
Yeah. Well, isn't it a coincidence that like every single day we happen to have enough work to fill a 9-to-5
yeah.
gap? You know, it's like, I still get that working for myself. Like I go to the office if I'm on time at about 9 o'clock and I leave at 5 and I go home.
Mm.
And I'm just sometimes I'm just sitting there and going like, oh God, I feel bad now because I've done all the stuff and more that I wanted to do today, but I still feel like I should just sit here for an extra 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then go home. And then if I do go home early, then I feel guilty.
Mm.
It's
scary how much that's hardwired into us.
Yeah, it really school, is, isn't it?
College.
School. It's work. Probably school.
Yeah. In 100, I literally had this chat with a friend of mine on Wednesday. We're just saying, and it took me, I'm in business, what, 4.5 years, maybe 5 years now. And it took me a good 2.5 to 3
yeah.
to eventually wean myself off that 9 to 5 and the guilt.
Yeah, the guilt. You feel like a rebel when you get in for a walk on the pier at 3 o'clock.
That nagging guilt, whereas now I'm actually able to enjoy exactly sitting down like someone like yourself on a Friday during a work day, inverted commas, because you just know what you have to do. I think it comes with experience too. I think after a certain amount of the time, you're like, you know what, I know what I have to do. I'll get it done. It doesn't matter if I sit down this evening at 6 and do 2-3 hours on the laptop.
Mm.
And then tomorrow morning, I don't have to do it.
Mm.
I think it's that. It's finding that balance. But that, it's bizarre, that feeling.
It is, isn't it?
It's definitely school, secondary school then, and then college, and then work. They're all geared towards that 9 to 5.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The Industrial Revolution brought that in, and we've just kept it.
Yeah, it is mad.
No one's productive.
For 8 hours.
Oh, they're just not. Some people are brilliant between, personally, I know I'm really good early in the morning up until about 2 o'clock in the day, 3 o'clock in the day. You know, creativity is high, productivity is high, confidence is high. And you've only so much of that in a day. So I'll do all the kind of good stuff during that time. And then after that, it's just, I'll do just the grunt work.
Yeah.
That you can do whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, I'm actually the exact opposite. It's grunt work is done first.
Really?
Yeah, and then I'll be distracted by something at about 12 p.m. Maybe I usually go to the gym then about 12 p.m. And then I come back and I'll get another chunk of work done from about 3 until 5, like good working. But I've always found like my best kind of creative ideas, my best ideas and proactive ideas come at nighttime, coming about 9 p.m. when I'm just sitting there and the mind's wandering, whatever, if I'm just watching TV, and then I kind of write them down or whatever. But yeah, like back to your initial question, like I'm really, really disorganized. And yeah, I feel like, you know, for the next person that hopefully if we were to employ an next person, I need them to probably become the chief organizer, you know, the whip cracker. Because I get distracted by things and I'm impatient. So if I come up with a new thing, it has to be done now. Even though it doesn't matter if it's done now or in a week or in 2 weeks.
You didn't even have the idea yesterday.
But exactly. Today it but has now to be it done. Feels yeah. like the be all oh, yeah. and end all. And then that comes in place of the other thing and, you know, blah, 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 and then I'm all messy. And then I have like in my notes app on my laptop, I have multiple different notes with competing task lists and stuff, like, you know, scattered around. So yeah, no, that's something I need to work on. It's the getting control of all the stuff that this business entails and organizing it better and just being a bit more mindful, you know, because mindfulness is extremely difficult when you have a business like this. When we were talking earlier about how much nicer it would be if your online business was a subscription model. At least you can sleep at night, you know, because you know that next month when all those payments hit, it's consistent. Whereas for us, we essentially have to find like new customers every day, you know. There's a lot of people in the world though, so we tend to find them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, sometimes if you have a bad day or if your conversion rate drops by 0.2% and you're panicking all the time, it can be worrying. But what I have to teach myself is, so I'm sorry to go on about it, is that it's always figured itself out over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
It's always got better. If you look at the graph on a whole, it's up, all the time.
To be able to say that is rare though. I think to have, be able to say, yeah, each day is just a little bit better. And I think if you're building a business like you are, it sounds like you're building a business for 20 years, not 2 years. I think that's the trap a lot of people are falling into now. People are thinking short term. People are thinking, oh yeah, you know, in 6 months and then a year and then 2 years, that'll be it. Whereas like no great brands were built in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. It always takes, a friend of mine was like, whatever you think, treble it. If you think it'll take a year, it'll take three.
Yeah.
And that's true.
Yeah.
No matter what you're doing as an entrepreneur, like you always like the idea is great, but then it's the execution of the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's hard to have that. How do you keep sustaining that self-belief? I'm interested in that as well from entrepreneurs. Like a lot of it tends to be a strong thing. And we're all riddled with kind of anxiety in one point, but also you have to get that self-belief. Where does that come from for you?
I'm pretty competitive. I like the feeling of being, I know I don't want to sound, it sounds a bit, but I like the feeling of being the best at something, do you know what I mean? Like it's really satisfying.
Yeah.
And like that keeps me going. Like I'm driven. I have the vision in my mind is to be the best brand in the world at this particular niche in eyewear. And that kind of keeps me, that vision kind of keeps you going. Like you forget all else, like just kind of work towards that and do your little bits every day that will get you to there. But there is lots of downs. Like there's little downs that happen really regularly. Like, you know, someone leaves you a bad review, you know, or something like that.
Oh, I know that from being in the Airbnb game. That's the one that sticks with you.
Someone that leaves you, like you get like 99 great reviews and you get one and that's the one that kills you for 2 days. and you know, you keep it on your mind, but that type of stuff, and then you go home and you're just like, oh, why do I bother? I bet there's one little thing, and maybe it's to do with your mood that day or whatever. But then on the other side, then you have something like, I get a random email out of the blue, and it's like someone from the Sunday World magazine who wants to do a spread on Amber Eyewear, just completely randomly.
Yeah,
and right. Then you're just like, cool. Like people think, and then they're like, oh, I've seen your brand around, I think it's really cool. And then you're like, ah, like this is cool. This is what's
happening. Yeah.
It's those little things. And then also I love seeing the good reviews are I know it sounds incredibly cheesy, but that actually is kind of what you're set out to do really in business, isn't it? You're set out to just provide people with a service or a product that makes their life better. And, you know, we got a review the other day from somebody, and it was like, I had been suffering for years from headaches. And like, I use a dual screen at work. I visited the optician, and they told me that there was nothing they could do. My eyesight was perfect. I had blood tests and everything. And then they said, like, from the minute I put on Amber Eyewear glasses, my symptoms had disappeared overnight. And I swear to God, like, this is the type of reviews you get. And then you're like, that person seems so happy, and I'm so happy that we could make them that happy, you know? And that's a great feeling as
that
well.
That feeling to have made a genuine impact. Like, a lot of businesses talk absolute nonsense about, oh, you know, our mission is to make an impact in the world, and they're selling absolute garbage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whereas you're actually, to have an actual impact in someone's day-to-day life and their health, more importantly, like, that must be a great...
Yeah, I forget about that a lot, actually. You forget about the other side of it, that there's loads of people wearing these glasses and they bloody love them, you know? And then you're like they can't wait to put them on in the morning. And that's a really cool feeling.
What was it like when you saw someone wearing your glasses for the first time that wasn't your dad or something like that? What was that feeling when you just saw them out in the wild, out in the streets of Dublin somewhere? What was that feeling like?
I saw a guy in the dark wearing them. And I just was like... I asked him where he got his. I was staring at him real weird, and he was kind of glancing at me. What's this lad looking at me? And then I was like, "Are they Amber Eyewear glasses?" And he was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Do you like them, do you?" And he's like, "Yeah, if I do, yeah." And I was like, "That's my company." And then he was like, "Oh, good man."
Did we just become best friends?
Yeah. those things are great. You know, there's downsides to this, as I talked about, like with the mindfulness thing and the effect it has on your it's the 24/7 thing, but at the same time, like, all those things are just great buzz and great feelings of satisfaction, and they far outweigh the bad things, you know. So yeah,
that's cool. I have two final questions for you. One you can think about for a minute. We always get people to recommend a book, so you can just think about that for a minute. My second last question is, you are in business with your girlfriend. So what's it like? You're the second or third entrepreneur I've had in the last couple of weeks who are actually in business with their partner. So how do you balance that between work and say play?
We spend every waking minute together, I suppose. And hasn't been that long yet. She's only been full-time since February.
Okay.
But we're good contrasting people, you know, like she loves to kind of go off on she's very much the creative brain of things. I'm kind of more the kind of extroverted kind of person who handles the outside communication and the marketing and stuff like that. So we kind of complement each other well. But it is weird, like when you leave the house, you're like, right, see you in the office in 5 minutes, right? And then also raising a three and a half year old now as well. So it's weird. I'm just so used to it. I don't really know what it's like without. I do miss having a group of work friends, you know, and that kind of social life. But you know, like before we came back from, because we started going out in New York when we both lived there. And then we did a bit of traveling together in South America, just the two of us. And then we came back from South America at Christmas 2014. And then Sasha got pregnant in January 2015. So there was never really a time over the last like 6 years that you haven't been on some sort of adventure together.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
Whether that's, you know, working in Manhattan or traveling South America, having a baby, starting a business. It just is weird, actually. It's just evolved. So I'm pretty used to it now. But it's nice for me to come in and do something like this, I live in Dún Laoghaire, I work in Dún Laoghaire, I'm feckin' always in Dún Laoghaire. Okay. So it's nice to come in to the big smoke. Yeah. And just hang around people for
the
a while.
The sights and sounds.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't find it, I don't find it bad at all. In fact, I kind of like it. You know,
it's cool. Yeah. So what book? So every week we give away a book. So all people have to do to win is tag myself and Amber Eyewear on social media. It can be LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, whatever they like. Just tag us, share the episode, and they're in chance to win a book. What book has made? It can be anything. It can be personal. It can be professional. It doesn't have to be about business. What book has kind of like made an impact on you in the last couple of years?
I'm sure there's been ones that have far more so made an impact on me over the last couple of years, but it's very difficult to think when you're kind of put on the spot. But I was listening to the audiobook. There's obviously a written version of the, I don't know, do you know who David Goggins is?
Yes.
The madman.
Yes. But I haven't read it yet.
The Navy SEAL motivator, crazy man.
Mm.
But his book, Can't Hurt Me, I was listening to it on audiobook there. And if you ever get lazy or you have doubts about, I don't know, even going for a walk or something like that, he'll make you feel very bad about it. It's an incredible
just
book.
Get it done.
I've never listened to some guy
really,
yeah, like, I mean, he was explaining how he had a goal of like becoming a Navy SEAL or whatever, and he was really, really overweight, and some of the stuff he used to do, like he used to run like, I don't know, like 100 kilometers through like wet swamp or something like that until his feet were like torn up with blisters, just to put himself through as much pain as possible. Wow. So that when he was actually training for like Navy SEALs or whatever, it was easy. Do you know what I mean?
Wow. Yeah.
And he calls it what's he called? He calls it like building a what are they called on your fingers when you get
blisters?
The hard things.
Oh, calluses.
Calluses. Yeah, mind calluses. So like the more really like bad things you put yourself through, it hardens your, it builds calluses on your mental.
That's
strength.
Fascinating.
You know what I mean?
A lot of fighters talk about that, about training hard, fighting easy.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So David Goggins, Can't Hurt Me.
Yeah.
You're the second person actually in a week to recommend that. I saw Pat Phelan talk about that on his Instagram story. He was raving about it. He was recommending, he was giving books away to people. He was so good. Mm. So brilliant. We'll give that away.
Cool.
Dan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for meeting, Gary. Enjoyed it.
And that's it for another episode of The Entrepreneur Experiment. If you did enjoy the show, please do me a favor and leave it a review on iTunes. I'm trying to get the show as high up in the charts as possible so more people can discover it. To win Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins, as Dan recommended, just simply share the episode and tag me, Mr. Gary Fox, and Amber Eyewear on social. So it can be LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. Just be sure you tag me, otherwise I won't see it. I actually started listening to this book on Audible a few days after Dan was in the studio, and it's absolutely incredible. The Audible book is actually very, very interesting, so I'd recommend downloading that as well. That's it for episode 23. I will see you next Thursday at 6 a.m.